Good morning, and you are listening to WWGH here in Marion, Ohio. Happy Veterans Day, and it should be a happy day. You should be celebrating our veterans today. This is not Memorial Day. We are not mourning those that are passed. Celebrate Veterans Day. Celebrate everyone you know who is a veteran. Give them a smack on the back and say, thanks for your service. Okay, well, now we listened to an absolutely terrific interview in the first period of this show. At that time, he was a young man. It was recorded, I don't know, probably 20 years ago. And he talked about being in Vietnam. I have another interview that I'm going to play for you now was a gentleman who was... let's see if I can get it up here. oh, great. Now I've lost him. Okay. Wow. Oh, here he is. There we go. Now we're getting there. Maybe. I had a veteran who was on the beaches of Normandy, and I seem to have lost him. Let's see if I can find him here. I will keep on looking through my sights here. It's not coming back here. All right. Well, I'm... very disappointed that I lost that. I wasn't supposed to lose that one. Let me see if I've got it in another place here in my phone. It doesn't look like I do here. Well, maybe I'll have to give you another one. We do have several Vietnam veteran speeches, and maybe that's what I'll play for you again. I don't want to play the ones that are an hour and a half long. That might not work for you. But the reason why I'm playing this, because very few veterans speak about their what went on in Vietnam. I find it, if they can find the courage to get back and talk to us about their service, quite often it is... very enlightening, and most of them don't speak about it like, oh boy, wasn't it fun, because it wasn't fun. They did what they had to, oh, I think I found it. They did what they had to do because they were ordered to do it, and here we go. I'm going to have to get through the computer, the ads as well, but here we go. This is a World War II vet.
I had two brothers and a sister. And we lived in a neighborhood like today. You know, the mall is full. When we lived in Brooklyn, everything was a block away. If you wanted to go to a grocery store or a drugstore or anything like that, all you do is walk one block and everything... was there for you. And then, of course, I went to a high school called Lafayette High School. It was a wonderful school. And I only put 3.5 years in there. I left the high school in my senior year. I think there must have been about 16 boys. We all volunteered at the same time. Each one of us took a different... either Army or Navy or Coast Guard, whatever it may be. And my mom, God bless my mother, she had three sons. My brother was in the Army, and he went as far in the Third Army, with Patton's Army. He went into Germany. And, of course, I did the Atlantic and the Pacific. And my kid brother, we were so happy that he missed the Second World War. Then the Korean War came along. And he volunteered to go into the Marines. He was in the Chosin Reservoir when the Chinese hordes came over the top. And luckily he survived. He was a BAR man. So my poor mother, she had three kids, all in combat. I don't know how she did it. My mother was a very strong person.
Why did you decide to sign up when you were in high school? What drove you to do that?
When Pearl Harbor happened, everybody was patriotic. Everybody wanted to go into the service and do their part. And I first started enlisting at 17, but my mom wouldn't sign for me. And I wanted to get in before the war ended. I thought in a year the war would end. I didn't know it was going to last 4 years. So I was anxious to get in. And I have no regrets. I met some very, very wonderful people. And I lost a lot of people.
What was it like after you got in for you?
What's that?
What was it like after you got in the military for you?
When I got in?
Yeah.
You know, when you go into the military, what they do, they break you down. The first day that you're in, either the master sergeant or the chief petty officer says, I want you to forget everything that you know up till today. Because from today on, you're going to be military. You're going to do it our way. And it's very ironic because today, a lot of kids are committing suicide. The kids from Vietnam and Iraq, and we're losing a lot of kids from suicide. And I think the reason is because when we went in the service, we did 2 or 3 weeks basic training. And they taught us how to be military. And when the war ended, they gave me a piece of paper and $86 and put me on a train and sent me home. I was a lost person. We were all lost. They broke us down to bring us into the service, but they didn't do anything to, you know, make it easy for us coming out. They should have like a basic training when you leave the service. That's why a lot of kids today, they come home and they're lost. The first time I had liberty, I remember I had liberty. I couldn't wait to go home to see my mom. I had 2 weeks. And I went there, and the first day I was very happy. I saw my mom and my brothers and sisters. The next day, my mom went to work. My kid brother went to school. My dad went to work. And there was nobody in my neighborhood my age because they were all in the service. And I was lost. I couldn't wait to go back to my ship. I was so happy to get liberty, and after 2 days, I was happy to go back.
That is interesting. So, 75 years since D-Day now, which I'm sure doesn't seem like it to you.
No, it's yesterday.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Is it hard to think back on that?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people don't realize D-Day, they wrote a lot of books and a lot of movies about it. The whole D-Day was only 18 hours. We dropped the boats at 4 o'clock in the morning, and 10 o'clock at night, the beach was ours. It was only 18 hours, the whole thing. People make a big spectacle out of it, you know, D-Day, D-Day. It was 18 hours, that's all it was. But we did lose 2,000 men on the beach. I said men, I shouldn't say men. 2,000 kids. We were all kids. We were all kids. We were too young to drink. We were too young to vote. We weren't too young to die. 18 years old, 19, 20 years old, they were kids. Some of them didn't even shave. Never shaved. Yeah. And you're fighting Germans that were in the war for 4 years. Some of them came out of Russia. They were seasoned. And with all that, the season, us 18, 20-year-old kids, we ripped their ass.
Yes, indeed.
Sorry.
No, that's all right.
I shouldn't use that language.
That's all right. What do you remember about that day?
What I remember the most. I'm going to tell you a story. I don't tell it to anybody, because it's so hard for me. On the first wave, my job was to drop the ramp. And the machine guns were hitting the ramp in the front of the ramp. But I knew when I dropped the ramp, the machine gun was going to come into the boat. But I had to drop the ramp because the troops had to get out. This is the first wave. So when I dropped the ramp, the Germans had 14 machine guns, MG-42 machine guns, capable of 160 rounds a minute. When I dropped the ramp, all those machine guns opened up. And in the front of my boat, 7, 8, 10, 15 kids, I don't know, they just went down like you're cutting wheat. Now, I was three quarters of the way back because I had to take the ramp and drop the ramp. So I was three quarters of the way back. So I had some protection because the kids that were in front of me, the troops that were in front of me.
History is filled. You can tell that that gentleman, even though the interview was done about, I think about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, even though it's been that long, he is really taken by it. Let's go back.
The bullets that were supposed to hit me, and they were falling down. And there was two kids, stragglers, I call them stragglers. They kept back because they didn't want to be in front of the boat because they knew they would die. So they stayed back, and they stayed near me, which is a bad thing because besides the machine guns on the beach, there was a machine gun in the hill. And they were shooting down from the hill. So that was in a crossfire. And these two boys, since they stayed close to me, they were drawing fire to me. Now, the first boy was about 4 feet away from me. He got a machine gun in his stomach. His stomach was sticking out of his. Luckily, that kid, somehow, he survived the war, even though his stomach was ripped open. The second kid, he was about two feet away from me. He wasn't so lucky. The machine gun took his helmet off and part of his skull. And he was crying, "Help me, help me, help me." And he fell at my feet. And I couldn't help him. I had no morphine. I had nothing to help him. So the only thing I could do, I started praying for him. Our Father who art in heaven. And I never finished the prayer. And it seemed to soothe him. He stopped screaming, "Help me, help me," when I said the prayer. Then I reached down. And I touched his hand. Because I wanted him to know he wasn't alone. What little strength that he had, he put his fingers around my thumb and squeezed my thumb. It was almost as if he was saying, "It's all right, it's all right." But I knew he was going to die. And at that moment, he spit up blood and he died. He died. He was a kid, probably 18, 19, 20 years old. He had red hair. He died right in front of me. And I went into shock, I'll be honest. I went into shock. He was just a little boy. Just a little boy. I went into shock and I passed out. And I came to, I don't know, maybe a minute, 2 minutes. I don't know how long it was. And when I passed out, when I came to, rather, the coxswain was yelling, "Pick the ramp up, let's get out of here," because we were in a crossfire. And I pulled the lever and nothing happened. I pulled it the second time, nothing happened. I pulled it the third time, then I put it on automatic. It never came up. So my job now was to take that ramp. Everybody was depending upon me. So I had to get to the ramp. I was three quarters of the way back. I couldn't even see the ramp because there were dead bodies in front of me. So I had to crawl over the dead bodies. And I must have been a madman because I was crying. And I'm saying to these kids that are dead, forgive me for walking over you. And I started going towards the ramp. And somehow another kid came along. To this day, I don't know who it is. Either a crewman or maybe another soldier. I don't know. And we started crawling towards the ramp. And when we got towards the ramp, I realized why the ramp wouldn't come up. There was two dead soldiers on the ramp. They never got out of the boat. So they were waterlogged because they were on the ramp. Plus they had 90 pounds of, each soldier had 90 pounds of equipment on their back. Excuse me a second. There was no way I was going to move this guy. I weighed 125 pounds. I couldn't lift him up. So what I did, I pointed to his belt, to the other guy. And I grabbed the belt, and I started pulling. And when I pulled, he moved about 2 or 3 inches. And right then and there, I knew I could do this. I could do this. So I, little by little, probably took 40 minutes, 30 minutes, I don't know. I got him off the ramp, and the ramp went up. Now the coxswain had to get the boat. There was all obstacles in the water. There was mines in the water, and we were right in the middle of them, and there was telephone poles. And the top of the telephone poles was the mine, just sitting there. It wasn't nailed down or screwed down. It was just sitting on top of the telephone pole. If your boat nudged that telephone pole, the mine would come in your boat, killing everybody. But these were not an ordinary mine. These were telemines. A telemine, when they explode, they don't explode up. They explode sideways, take a man's legs off. So the coxswain, God bless him, he was so good. He got us out of this mess. And we headed back to my ship. And we had a lot of boys that were wounded pretty bad. And they were crying, Mama, Mama, Mama. And when we headed towards my ship, we saw this big white ship with a Red Cross on the side. It was a hospital ship. So instead of going towards my ship, we went towards the hospital ship. Because we figured if we can get some of these wounded guys aboard that hospital ship, maybe we could save some lives. If we could save one life, it was worth it. So we pulled alongside the hospital ship.
We will listen to the rest of that after their commercial is over. It's really hard to not cry while listening to that gentleman explain all the horrors that were going on. Let's go back.
I called them angels because they did something we couldn't do. We were spent. We couldn't do anything. And what they did, they peeled off the dead soldiers to get to the wounded soldiers. And they were able to get about 7. I don't remember exact. Could have been 7, could have been 8, I don't know. And they got these wounded boys, and they put them in the hospital ship. And I said to myself, I said, thank God, these kids stand a chance. Maybe they're going to live this day. And with that, the two guys that were on the boat went back to the hospital ship, and we went back to my ship. when we got back to my ship, we still had wounded aboard. Not serious, but we had wounded aboard. And we had dead aboard the boat. So when we got close to my boat, they dropped a sled so we could put the dead bodies and the wounded. And then the crane took them up. And somebody yelled, I want one man from every boat to come aboard to be interrogated. So I got on the sled and I went aboard. And when I went aboard, I'm on the ship. Stay with me a minute, stay with me. I'm alive. I'm alive. And I gotta make a decision. Do I stay aboard the ship and let somebody take my place? Or do I go back into the belly of the beast and face those machine guns again? And I said to myself, this is what I was trained to do. And I made 15 trips. They told me, I didn't know that. They told me we made 15 trips with my boat. The PA-2628 made 15 trips. So then I had to be interrogated. There was a naval officer and a sergeant. He had a lot of stripes on him, great big sergeant. He put his hand on my shoulder. He said, son, that hand was like a hug. I needed a hug. And he touched me. And he said, son, he says, those machines can only fire so long. Then they have to change the barrel. You wait. And when they're changing the barrel, that's when you drop the ramp again. So I said, all right. I said, how much time do I have? He said, 7 to 10 seconds. That's not much time. But I did like he told me. And I waited and I waited. And while I was waiting, the troops aboard the boat start screaming, let the ramp down, we got to get out of here. They feel closed and they wanted to go out and be killed. So I waited and I waited and I waited, and all of a sudden there was a lull. They had to change the barrels, and I dropped the ramp, and this time I got 8 guys on the beach. Of course, they were cut down immediately. I'd rather not go any further.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You talked earlier about how you didn't talk about this for a long time. Why'd you decide to talk about it now?
For 70 years, I never mentioned it. My family, my son is here, he can tell you. When we're on the beach with Tom Brokaw, and Tom Brokaw says to me, he says, I understand you have a big book with all pictures of the battles that you fought. And my son said, what book? I never told anybody anything. It was too hard to talk about. So somehow, Tom Brokaw, he got it out of me. He asked me a few questions. And once the genie was out of the bottle, you can't put it back. And then after that, I wanted to talk about it. And I go to seminars, I go to Columbine High School, and I talk to these young kids. I went to the USAA, the insurance company, and I talked to them. I wanted to get out now so they don't forget what we had to go through. We fought for peace. The Germans fought to kill, and we fought for peace.
You're going back for the 75th anniversary in June. And you're taking your whole family, you said, and a lot of your friends, and a big group. And what do you think it's going to be like, thinking back 75 years at that time?
It's going to be a madhouse. It's going to be a madhouse. The 70th anniversary, there were buses backed up from here to Brooklyn. I mean, nothing moves. This is going to be the 75th. It's going to be much, much, much worse. Nothing's going to move. we already got some itineraries that they're closing highways. Nobody's going to get through. The highways are going to be closed. So if you want to go to the beach, you got to get there probably 4 o'clock in the morning before everything starts. Because if you wait till later on, you're not going to see anything. Yeah.
But it's important to you to go back.
It's very important for me to go back, yeah, yeah. And God bless people like Jake who take us back. Because if it wasn't people like Jake, we probably wouldn't go back because it's very expensive. Maybe we would have done it one time, but not 11 times, 10 or 11 times. It's two people like him that were able to do this.
You not only think it's important to pass along this message to kids, obviously, because you talk to kids a lot, but when you go back with kids and say you're on the beach or whatever, or in one of the museums or whatever, and you see their faces, what does it mean to you?
You mean the kids?
Yeah.
You know, we have a tendency in this country to put the young generation down. We got a great generation coming up. These kids are great. They're smart. They're much smarter than I was, than all of us were. And I love talking to them because they ask very pertinent. One of the kids asked me if I was killed during the war. But other than that, they ask some very, very, very good questions. So I can see I'm getting through to them. About 3 or 4 months ago, the church that I went to, that I go to, the Monsignor, he knew that I was in the war. And he said, Frank, he says, how about talking to the congregation? So I said, all right. And the whole church was there. And I gave my spiel like I just told you and stuff like that. And then there was question and answers. And one woman raised her hand. And she said to me, why don't you write a book?
Introducing the health plan, a fresh choice for Columbus.
Well, now, that quite an interesting interview, and I'm going to cut it off there. He has a little bit more, but we're going to cut it off, and we'll get... Whoop! I thought I cut it off. Hang on 1 second. Something's wrong here. I'm not a very good technician. That's the problem. All right. Well, I hope that you enjoyed listening to that. I must admit that tears welled up in my eyes more than once. And that's something that, you know, listening to both a Vietnam era vet and a World War II vet, someday maybe we can do a Korean vet and we can do a Middle Eastern vet, you know, Iraq or Iran or one of those, and Afghanistan. I haven't found any interviews of the later groups, but I'm sure they're there. But I hope you enjoyed that. It really, enjoy is not the word. I hope that you found it enlightening. That's why so many of the vets who are actually what we used to call in the Vietnam era, we called in country, and so many of those that were in country don't like to talk about it. I mean, they saw some things that I don't know how you lived through. they saw, you know, like the gentleman was talking about the kids that were killed on the front of his landing boat. I don't know how he stood that, but I think what you do is you kind of go into a little bit of a shock, and you just keep doing what you were trained to do. Now, he mentioned that they only had, during World War II, they only had three weeks of basic training. When I went in during the Vietnam era, we had 9 weeks of basic training. And one of the reasons I think we had 9 weeks of basic training is that it was guerrilla warfare and it was jungle warfare. So they had to teach you different things. They had to teach you how to identify the dangerous areas, how to identify a booby trap, how to identify catapult that would throw things at you, or that would, you know, they had ways of putting devices up that would stab you. You trip the wire and this knife or blade or bamboo shoot would come flying out and slam into your chest and kill you that way. So we had to learn all those different things. We also had to go into, and I imagine they did this too during World War II and also the other wars. They took us into, you know, we went into a tear gas bunker, and we went into a chlorine gas place, and you learned to use your gas mask and that sort of thing. Those of you who are vets know exactly what I'm talking about. Anyway, it's, well, I can't imagine talking about things like that the latter gentleman talked about, but either one of the gentlemen. And it was interesting that the interview with the gentleman from Vietnam admitted killing people, who wanted to kill people. You know, another problem that happens, I don't know if you've ever shot an animal that didn't die, and you want it to die because you want to take it out of its misery, and so you shoot it and shoot it and shoot it, you know, or you hit it with a bat or something like that. Soldiers did that type of thing as well, and it's ugly. Someday we will learn, and one of the reasons why I listen to so many Vietnam-era songs, 1960s and 70s and, yeah, 60s and 70s music, is because they're trying to tell us, let's find love. And that's not a wimpy thing. I have friends I know that would say Glenn is a wimp because he wants to find love. And I don't mean kissy kissy love. I mean concern for your fellow man and woman, no matter their color, no matter their sex, no matter their sexual preference, no matter where they come from. If we could learn to, you don't have to hug and kiss the people you love. All you have to do is respect them, and that's something we struggle to do. There are people that just hate people because they're on the other team. And I find that really aggravating. I hope that we can all be a little bit kinder to each other. And I've said that for 75 years. My father said it before me. My mother and sister said it before me. And it doesn't seem to make any difference. We still want ours. We want our stuff. We want our money. We want, you know, and we don't care about that other person. You know, the other person has feelings too. But for some reason or other, there are people, some people can empathize with other people. Another, some people just don't get it. I'm not sure it's ignorance. I think it's just a thing that, a way they're made up. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed the last couple of hours and listening to some of those two interviews. I appreciate the website, and I was trying to find the name of it, and I could not quickly enough to tell you, but maybe I can look at it in the break, and I'll tell you where you can find those interviews. And there are not dozens, there are hundreds of interviews from people from all wars, and even there are interviews from people that were in Auschwitz. There were interviews from of things that are not necessarily war, but very trying times and places, and so they're quite interesting. You might enjoy it. I'll try to find out what that website is, and I'll give that to you. So anyway, we're gonna try to lighten things up a bit here. A little heavy. We got about 12 minutes to go before we take the break to go to the news and the weather. And it sounds to me like our weatherman Adam is kind of excited that we might get a little snow. I am not excited about snow. I'm sure my little puppy dog is not going to be excited about snow. I don't know that my little puppy dog has ever seen snow. I'm not quite sure where he came from. A lot of the dogs that we looked at had been shipped up to homes here in Ohio from Texas. So maybe, I don't know that Buddy's ever seen snow. We'll find out pretty soon, I guess. Adam says it might be this weekend, so we'll find out. I've got a bunch of facts about our military, and I thought maybe it'd be interesting on Veterans Day to hear some of these facts. The Department of Defense, or what they call the DOD, is the largest employer in the United States. There are more than 1.4 million active duty personnel. There's 1.1 million National Guard and Reserve people, and there are 700,000 civilians working for the DOD. That's a lot of people. A lot of people are getting paychecks from the Department of Defense. Bunches and bunches of people. 31 of the 44, well, there are now more than 44 presidents, but 31 of them have served in the military. President Teddy Roosevelt earned the Medal of Honor. I think he's the only president that earned the Medal of Honor. That is the highest honor you can get in the military. The only enlisted president, the rest of them, the other 30, were officers, but the only enlisted president who didn't become an officer ever was James Buchanan. So that's kind of an interesting fact. I guess it probably has something to do with their educational level. I remember when I went into basic training, after about 6 weeks, I was called down to the sergeant major's office, and they tried to talk me into going into OCS, Officers Candidate School. And I knew I already had orders cut that I would go right to Washington, D.C. and be in the Army field band. So I didn't want to become an officer because I knew where I was going to go. And so I resisted. But I know the reason why they invited me to do that is I had quite a bit of college. At that point, I had not graduated, but I had at least 3 years of college in the bank. And they felt that I would be a good officer. I think I would have been a terrible officer. Let's see. The U.S. military is one of the largest providers of international aid and disaster relief. Ships called Marine Expeditionary Units patrol the oceans. They watch for signs of danger, and they reach. They can reach shorelines of nearly any location on Earth within about 48 hours. That's pretty fast, especially if you're on a ship. It's called the Marine Expeditionary Unit, and they're all over the place keeping an eye out for us. Another reason why we should honor our vets. Most of the time, well, I'm not sure most of the time. I guess I read somewhere that of our well over 200 years of history, only 24 have been war-free. That's kind of, I'm not sure if it's embarrassing, but it is painful to hear. The Department of Defense owns nearly 30 million acres of land worldwide. In the U.S., it's the single largest consumer of energy, the DOD is. Now, I wonder what will happen once we go to more and more solar power, wind power, and that sort of thing, whether that will, the DOD will cut that way back. But they own 30 million acres of land worldwide. You know, that's all the air bases and all the forts and all the, you know, the places throughout the world where our troops are stationed. It includes, I'm sure, our ambassadors locations, the embassy locations. So anyway, 30 million acres of land. Only 28% of Americans ages 17 through 23 are eligible for military service. And when you know that only 7% of Americans are vets, that kind of shows you why only 7% are vets, because it sounds like only a quarter of the people are even eligible to be in military service. Nearly 1.4 million Americans, or about 0.4% of the U.S. population, are active duty military personnel. That's why those numbers are going to be pretty low. So not only if you're a vet, have you served your country, but you're one of the few. And I guess that's why my friend from Athens told me, you know, don't feel bad about not going to Vietnam. Be proud that you were able to serve. And I guess I should be. But I am always embarrassed when people ask me, what did I do during Vietnam? Sing in the United States Soldiers Chorus. I'll live. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I'm alive is because I was there, not in Vietnam. Military members are more highly educated than the general population. Now, isn't that interesting? That did surprise me when I found that note out. Military members are more highly educated than the general populations. Those who enlist are required to have a high school diploma or a GED, so therefore you're going to take out all the people that haven't finished high school and all the people that haven't gotten a GED, so naturally you're going to be more educated than those people. That means that 99% of the military has a high school education. On the other hand, only 60% of the general population has a high school education. That surprised me. Now, a lot of those people that are in the other 40% have GEDs and that sort of thing. So, or they went to technical training right out of, you know, while they were in high school and just didn't get their high school diploma. They may have gone into I can't remember the name of it. They may have learned a craft. Excuse me, I had to turn the volume down because I had to sneeze and cough. The Lewis and Clark expedition that mapped out the West would not have even happened without the United States Army. We remember that only as explorers and as members of the expedition were they were actually a small army unit, Lewis and Clark. I doubt that many people even think of it that way. They think of them as explorers that went to the West Coast and found ways to get there. But they were part of the Army. That's how they were paid. That was how they were mandated and what to do. And the Lewis and Clark expedition did much of the mapping of the West before many people had gone that way. Army officers, I lost my place. Army officers were some of the first American citizens to see Pike's Peak and the Grand Canyon, because they were with Lewis and Clark, I guess. Can you imagine being a soldier and if you've not been to the Grand Canyon, it's kind of a hole in the ground that you don't see till you get there. And it's a big, big hole. I remember when we went there, I kept saying, I wonder where it is. And then all of a sudden we were there. A beautiful place to go. I'd like to go back. The USL military began. Oh, I have a phone call. Let's go to the phone. What do you say? All right. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, now, what part of the Army were you in, did you say?
I was in the United States Army Field Band. I was a special bandsman out of Washington, D.C.
Did you retire from there?
No, I spent my 3 years. I enlisted and spent my 3 years there.
Oh, you were just in the boot camp deal?
I'm sorry?
Earlier you said you were in the boot camp and then you couldn't go to the Army.
No, I was in boot camp before I went to the Army Field Band. Everybody had to go through boot camp. You couldn't get out of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, what time did you go in there? Like for the Vietnam or
68 through 72, I guess it was.
Oh, okay. Because my uncle, he was in Vietnam,
uh-huh.
And he has real bad nightmares when.
Yeah.
About that stuff. He won't talk about certain things.
Yep, I understand that completely, and I have friends that are the same way. And there were people on our radio station this morning that were talking about situations like that.
I heard that.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I wanted to call you. Where I work at Denny's,
uh-huh.
When you get done with the radio station,
yeah.
And for everybody that, you know, every Veterans Day, Denny's gives away a free, if you're a veteran, you got to show your ID.
Uh-huh.
You get a free Grand Slam.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm down to 10 seconds, so I'm going to have to let you go, but that's good to know. Thank you
all
very
right.
much. Have a great
yep.
day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP, Marion, Ohio. The place to talk. Bob McGrath from Sesame Street.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood? In your neighborhood? Say, who are the people in your neighborhood? The people that you meet when you're walking down the street. The people that you meet each day.
Legendary newsman Hugh Downs. Did you ever think you would be referring to the NBC News anchor as doing something this stupid?
No, I never did think I would. I didn't think that could happen because, first of all, I think the way NBC itself has handled this is really not as smart as it could be. There could be a, you know, they got to quit using words like mistake and error and start saying what the truth is. That's what they're trying to get out. If they do that, they could get some public restoration of their credibility and help themselves a lot, but they're not doing that. They're still willing to call it a mistake, and that's dumb. It is dumb.
Legendary actor from Barney Miller, Abe Vigoda.
I'm gonna be 94 years old. I'm gonna be 94 years old. I'm so grateful to God.
And from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Mr. McFeely.
If there's anything you want, if there's anything you need, McFeely's delivery brings it to you here with speed. Yes, our speedy delivery is a speedy delivery. Speedy delivery to you, Scott.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio. The Talking Place. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Programming on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM is supported by CRT Mechanicals. Address 2842 Marion Waldo Road. Telephone number 740-225-4495. Webpage crtmechanicals.com.
Hey everybody, it's Pastor Steve Whitaker from the Pastor Spot. We are on every Tuesday at 5:15 and replay again on Wednesday at 3:15. We take pertinent issues of the day going on and look at them in a biblical perspective. So we'd love to have you listen and just, you know, call in, just get a conversation going and have a great time on the show.
Pastor Steve Whitaker is the pastor at Community Christian Fellowship in Prospect, Ohio. Address 209 East Water Street. The Marion Towers Apartments are a supporter of WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Address, 400 Delaware Avenue. Phone number, 740-387-9050. Programs on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM are brought to you by Williams Grass Cutters. Telephone number 740-272-0062. Website williamsgrasscutters.com. Facebook page at Williams Grass Cutters. Email w.grasscutters@gmail.com.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and